TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. 911 Unanswered Questions. From the International Inquiry into 911 in San Francisco in March of 2004. While the official inquiry into 911 held public hearings in Washington, D.C., a grassroots, international, investigative movement met in San Francisco for 3 days. While the national media served as a spectacle of unquestioned answers by U.S. government officials, the San Francisco conference presented an impressive array of unanswered questions. This is the second program in a 13-part series that presents the best research from the San Francisco 911 conference. Today, you will hear from Gray Brecken on 911 in the historical context of barbarism versus civilization. In his writings, for example, in the recent book Imperial San Francisco, Brecken talks about the resources plundered from the earth to create cities and empires. Oil and other resources have long driven international relations and covert operations. Gray Brecken raises an intriguing question. When and how did the United States become an empire bent on such plunder of resources abroad? Also, what pretexts did the rulers use to get the consent of the American people to support wars in foreign countries? Gray Brecken is a teacher of geography and history. He was adjunct professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He spoke on March 26, 2004, at the International Inquiry into 911 at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. Brecken stepped out on the very stage where on June 26, 1945, the United Nations Charter was signed, and he took note of that event. Here is Gray Brecken.
By the way, 59 years ago, the United Nations was formed here, actually, and just last year, people who always hated the idea of that institution pretty much killed it, in fact, and that has a lot to do, of course, with what we're here for today. Well, I want you to imagine that you are looking at history and almost everything else that humans do in a very uncustomary way, as if you were looking at the world through polarized lenses. For a little bit, bear with me, we're going to look at history as flows of energy. How many times recently have we been told that we're engaged in unremitting warfare between good and evil, between light and dark, between civilization and barbarism, but not in terms of energy? And we know which side we're on. We're on the side of civilization, since we represent its apex. And so it's only appropriate that America, still young and virile, and as resolute in purpose as when first set upon its great destiny by the founding fathers, should have returned a year ago to the place where civilization began in the Fertile Crescent, in Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers. We brought civilization back to where it began, but then somehow it went bad while we went good. We brought light to what had gone dark. We come to liberate the people and, incidentally, to help them develop the energy that lies under their wrecked and now radioactive soil. One could regard civilization, like humanity, indeed like all of life itself, as a constant quest for energy. The difference, however, between ourselves and your average fern or hawk or platypus is that they use only as much energy as they need to live and to reproduce themselves. They know the meaning of enough. They don't build cities or empires where there is never enough. Those Mesopotamian cities rose upon the surplus energy made possible by irrigated agriculture, which in turn made possible the division of labor, accounting, hierarchies, writing, leisure time, sciences, arts, architecture, and of course war. in order for the elites of those cities to get still more energy. At its very simplest, warfare is a vast expenditure of energy used to get more energy with which to fight more wars and so on. And yet we did get something in return for all that energy extracted from the earth and from the sun and concentrated in a few great cities. The lights went on. We created art and we created cities. We created knowledge and we stored it as we stored energy in granaries. We created libraries. But those libraries were not for us, they were for them. The elites who built and ran the cities and their empires knew that knowledge is power, and so they kept it for themselves. For us, they concocted belief systems that sent us to wars to get more energy for themselves. They created some of the most cockamamie belief systems, some of the most cockamamie religions you can imagine, to motivate thousands of little people to build temples and palaces and tombs and to go to war to get more energy with which to build and to accumulate more. Enough was a word that they have never added to their vocabularies. It happens over and over again. God is forever on the side of the victor, or the losers did something bad to merit his disfavor. History becomes a litany of wars fought in his name, masking the constant quest for yet more energy. And then, in the 18th century, something different happened. We call it, as sort of shorthand, the Enlightenment. A group of philosophers, mainly in snooty old France, proposed that humans could organize themselves in a different way. And the U.S. is the product of that. Chiefly, the founders proposed that people could rule themselves, but to do so, they would have to have access to the information that had formerly been monopolized by the few, and particularly by the priests. Government would not only be representative, but it should be transparent, so as to keep it honest and free of the tyranny to which it naturally would tend. Hence, we have freedom of the press, hence separation of church and state, hence libraries. And so Thomas Jefferson created a library which he made the centerpiece of his University of Virginia, and he started the Library of Congress. These were largely to enlighten the many. And these really, I think, represent a significant step forward in civilization. Now, these were noble ideals, but they were often more honored in the breach. The country and the cities grew, and as they grew, they required more energy, which they took from more distant sources, often by force. Because there was no state religion, there had to be some other motivating ideal by which large numbers of men would march or sail off to distant places to take and add them to what has often been referred to, or was at that time, as the Empire of Liberty. In 1845, a journalist named John O'Sullivan coined the phrase Manifest Destiny to describe why the U.S. must stretch from sea to shining sea and then some. Manifest destiny was code for God. While few bothered to ask how O'Sullivan or the politicians who used that term had channeled the deity and knew what he wanted for his chosen people, what he wanted them to do. At that time, what God apparently wanted was for the United States to attack its weak neighbor, Mexico, and take its northern half. God wanted the U.S. to have San Francisco Bay as its strategic gateway on the Pacific. But along with the bay came an enormous amount of real estate, gold, silver, copper, fine soils, and a huge surplus of energy, which would go a long way to making the U.S. a superpower in the 20th century. The glittering charm of Manifest Destiny was that it was so unmanifest that whenever called upon, it could justify taking all of Mexico, Canada, the Caribbean, the Western Hemisphere, and finally the Pacific Ocean itself. Stabs were made at all of these until 1898, just 50 years after the war with Mexico, when Manifest Destiny made a spectacular encore after a U.S. warship called the Maine mysteriously exploded in Havana Harbor, allowing the U.S. to righteously declare war on Spain and then to take most of its remaining overseas territories. What happened in 1898 and afterwards is remarkably similar to what we are going through right now. The splendid little war was so brief and glorious that it was immensely popular in this country, and those who opposed it were vilified as traitors. Nonetheless, there were many people who called it an imperial venture and a betrayal of America's founding principles. The most eloquent of those people was the elderly Mark Twain. Many of his fans were baffled that the great humorist could turn so bitter, so sarcastic, so treasonous. And so you've probably never read or maybe even heard of those last writings, which I think are among his best and most powerful and really demonstrate Twain's very deep humanity. What few Americans knew was that the war on Spain had been planned by a few men well before the Maine exploded. It was simply an excuse. The idea was to get the Philippines and Guam and annex Hawaii in order to control the Pacific Ocean. It was often said at that time that whoever controlled the Pacific Ocean would control the world. There was, however, a large fly in that ointment. The Filipinos didn't want to be occupied by another colonial power, and they fought back. The splendid little war soon turned into a very dirty, long war with no exit strategy and thousands of dead, diseased, maimed, and mentally wrecked sailors and soldiers returning to the homeland, while the Philippines, in turn, were simply wasted by scorched earth policy. It was a potential public relations disaster, so pundits were duly rolled out to explain it in the usual terms of bringing light to the dark places of the earth. Rudyard Kipling wrote The White Man's Burden to steel Americans to what they had to do in order to bring civilization to the dark places. God was by no means gone, but increasingly humanity and civilization and team spirit would stand in for him. Secretary of War Elihu Root assured Americans that the warfare has been conducted with marked humanity and magnanimity. San Francisco historian Hubert Howe Bancroft wrote, "It was worth to Spain all it cost in delivering her from her unprofitable colonies, and it was worth to the United States many times its cost as an object lesson teaching men how to kill their fellow men gracefully, humanely, and in all Christian charity. Never before was seen in war such zeal and patriotism, unattended by enmity, and where there was such an absence of any desire to inflict wanton injury upon the enemy." The Reverend Dr. Kirby told a rally of Methodist ministers in San Francisco that the Lord Jesus Christ is behind the bayonets. So you see that, in fact, our age has no monopoly on silliness. Most importantly, Americans were repeatedly told that their country, unlike any other then or ever before, had been inoculated by its founding ideals from error or evil, and those such as Mark Twain were just plain wrong, if not downright seditious. As the war in the Philippines dragged on, Professor Bernard Moses, who founded the Department of Political Science at the University of California, assured doubters that the patriotism of the American people is to make impossible the realization of the dreams of the prophets of evil, and backed by the morality and manhood of this nation is to lead it in the way that is right. Imagine, all of this was before movies. Just imagine the certainties that you could implant in minds by using Jimmy Stewart or John Wayne or a Wolf Blitzer or a Thomas Friedman. Now, I'm going to skip over the most of the next century, or we'd never get out of here. Those years are largely about the perfection of propaganda, or if you prefer, public relations, which is, of course, the way that you can move millions of people in unison, as well as about the shift from coal to oil and natural gas and nuclear energy, and of how those new sources of energy have changed the earth and have made the United States the superpower that it claims to be. As I wrote in Imperial San Francisco, families with names such as Rockefeller and Guggenheim, and I might have added Bush and Walker, made New York the new Rome, and like the Roman generals returning from Spain with booty, such dynasties provide the plebs with a spectacle of immense wealth brought home from distant lands, as well as suspicions of transnational conspiracies necessary to get it. Yet the fountain of wealth, power, and glamour that issues from the mine and the oil well has also decisively shaped the way we perceive and treat our planet, not as a farm, let alone as a garden, but as a minehead and a battlefield. Don't take it from me. Here's Teddy Roosevelt in 1906 when we still had presidents with brains. Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to befoul the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics is the first task of the statesmanship of the day. Pretty good words coming from a president in 1906. The first task of this regime is to indissolubly wed corrupt business and corrupt politics. And the dictionary definition of that form of government is, of course, fascism. In the 3+ years, which now seems an eternity, since a blatantly partisan Supreme Court turned over government to the loser and threw him to the oil industry and a sort of American Taliban, which, by the way, Margaret Atwood foresaw in her prophetic novel, The Handmaid's Tale, and I recommend that all of you rent the movie and see the Republic of Gilead to which we are, in fact, headed. In that time, immense and possibly irreparable damage has been done to constitutional law in this country, to international law, and especially to the terrestrial environment. This is anything but a conservative administration. It's the most radical regime in U.S. history, and its ruthless goals are there in the policy papers which you're going to hear about, which call for full-spectrum dominance of planet Earth, no matter what the cost to you and me and everything else that we value on this planet. It's all about securing more energy for the United States and its eternally no-fault ally Israel, while ignoring for as long as possible what the use of that energy is going to do to render our planet uninhabitable very soon. I'm here, as I'm sure most of you are, to try to learn what actually happened on the morning of 9/11, because up to now, we have not been allowed to know, as the survivors' families have tried to point out. I say this knowing that I will immediately lose my credibility, because we have been led to believe that here everything is out in the open, and that if you did not see it on CNN or Fox or read it in Time or Times, then it just didn't happen. Anyone who suggests otherwise, for example, that the plane crash of a liberal senator hated by the present administration, which was simply a timely incident that helped to throw the Congress entirely to the present illegitimate regime, might be anything other than an unfortunate accident, not worth much more than 2 days, maybe 3, of news coverage. That person must be a raving fruitcake. Conspiracies just don't happen in this country, all evidence to the contrary. Like the inability of this country to do any wrong, that idea has been firmly implanted in the minds of millions of Americans as armor plate against questions that should be asked about what happened that morning. All evidence to the contrary. There was a conspiracy that should concern us here very much, because it is much more serious than the previous conspiracy of Watergate in its implications for constitutional rule. It's called Iran-Contra. And in its brief hour squirming in the spotlight, it began to reveal some very ugly things about how a small cabal of totalitarian-minded crooks, lowlifes, and thugs with contempt for the Constitution took it upon themselves, or were ordered to do so, to run a secret government out of the basement of the White House. Among many other things, we learned in the hearings that summer that drugs were being flown into this country with no need to worry about interception by the FDA or anyone else, because it had apparently been taken care of higher up. But like a bad dream that evaporates quickly upon awakening, Iran-Contra has faded into the distant past, and when I try to teach it, I find that for young people these days, it's about as relevant as the Battle of Hastings. Ronald Reagan, called to testify, couldn't remember a thing. And who would want to press that kindly old uncle, anyway, about how he could have possibly remained ignorant about the magma that was percolating just below his Oval Office? When Bush Sr. became president, he pardoned the major participants, such as Cap Weinberger, making them unindicted co-conspirators, which I've always thought was an odd term since we don't have conspiracies here. And then his son sealed the records to historians so that we will probably never know what happened, because I suspect So the present regime is editing those records as they regularly do websites and scientific reports that come to conclusions that are not contained in the Old Testament. John Ashcroft, all the time it's happening. John Ashcroft, of course, instructed federal agencies that they need not honor Freedom of Information Act, and the so-called Justice Department would go to bat for them in stonewalling. Bush and Cheney then appointed most of those unindicted co-conspirators to the highest positions in their administration. Why have a secret government operating out of the basement when you can have one operating upstairs in broad daylight, since the Congress is willing to abdicate its responsibilities and the mass media will not point this out except when John Poindexter goes a little gaga and proposed total surveillance of U.S. citizens and a betting pool in terrorism futures? That's right. This is a government fundamentally run by criminals who once before subverted the Constitution in order to achieve their own imperial ends in Latin America and elsewhere. They're just doing it in the open now because they know that they can get away with it. And they understand far better than most Americans just how essential energy is for full-spectrum domination and for further enriching themselves. This is by far the most secretive administration ever. It really makes Richard Nixon look like a rank amateur by comparison. And I think it's so secretive because it has so very much to hide. And the press has, for the most part, been complicit in allowing it to get away with its constant daily subversion. Few are aware that investigative journalism is a dying, if not altogether dead, activity in this country. One of the very few who carries it on is Bill Moyers. And I would say that Bill Moyers, at the time of Iran-Contra, produced an absolutely splendid documentary called High Crimes and Misdemeanors. And had anybody taken that seriously, Reagan and Bush would have subsequently been in prison, but the mainline media completely ignored the conclusions of that. KQED shows how much it values Moyers' show called Now by scheduling it for the Siberian time slot of 10 p.m. on Friday and bumping it to later whenever that educational television station has the chance to broadcast 4 hours of Susie Orman's The Courage to be Rich or a retrospective of the Bee Gees. Cancel your subscriptions. I said that the United States was the product of the 18th century Enlightenment. What we are seeing in the 21st century is what I call the Great Endarkenment. Let me end then by going back to Mesopotamia less than a year ago, as U.S. forces shocked and awed Iraqis and moved into Baghdad. In less than a week, Baghdad's National Museum was looted and trashed. And then, of course, you heard that they'd found all the stuff and it was all okay, but that's not really true. You heard about that. But did you hear that Mosul's museum was also trashed, and it was pretty good, and that Iraq's universities were sacked and burned, and that its great archaeological sites continue to be looted to this day? Moreover, the Iraq National Library and the great Quranic Library were burned while American soldiers were ordered to guard the records in the oil ministry, as reported by Robert Fisk. I would scarcely know about it otherwise because the Chronicle didn't feel that this destruction merited an article of its own, and most people have never heard of it. And then we moved on to other things, like the president's landing on an aircraft carrier to announce that the mission had been accomplished. And I wondered if Leni Riefenstahl was dead at that time because it sure looked like she choreographed the whole thing. We moved on. Since we are a young nation, ever fixed on the future and immune to error, oblivious that we had just permitted the trashing of the irreplaceable records of the very foundations of civilization itself in our would-be campaign to save civilization. And we feel that the Iraqis should just get over it, along with the deaths of countless Iraqis and the destruction of their property. They should just get over it as we got over the coup d'etat of 2000. Or as I'm sure that we would get over the burning of the Library of Congress and the New York Public Library and Harvard Library and the Metropolitan Museum and the National Gallery and the Frick Gallery and the Chicago Art Institute and the Getty Museum within 4 days. It's really not that important, is it? And besides, we're getting rid of our libraries anyway because we can't afford them anymore. Are we just a little unclear on the concept of civilization, perhaps? At least those in the White House are. There's a great deal that those who have taken over Washington do not want you to know about what has been done and is being done in your name and the great danger to which those actions are exposing us all in order to get yet more energy and to build yet greater fortunes for themselves and for their colleagues. That's why I call this period the Great Endarkenment, and it is perhaps the greatest of all betrayals of the founding ideals of this nation, and the monopolized mass media shares a great deal of responsibility for propagating this giddy ignorance and this justified fear of what is to come. So, in the next several days, let us shine some light now into that darkness while we still can. Thank you very much.
That was the author, professor of geography and history, and well-loved activist, Gray Brecken. He spoke on the Great Endarkenment, placing 911 in the historical context of barbarism versus civilization. The international inquiry into 911, where Brecken spoke, was held in San Francisco in March of 2004. This is part two of a radio series on the best research and the list of unanswered questions presented at that inquiry. When TUC Radio returns, you will hear from Mike Rupert on the failure of the U.S. military to protect the World Trade Center and its own headquarter, the Pentagon. Rupert presents an impressive timeline on the fact that the military violated standard operating procedures and did not send up fighter planes on time to intercept the hijacked planes. You can find more information on the international inquiry into 911 on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour tape or CD of the first two segments, the opening press conference, and Gray Brecken, by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. For information on how to order, you can get this program by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.